is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Allen County Right to Life, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Amanda Banks, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Amanda Banks.
And I'm Scott Kump. Choose Life News and Views is a joint project of Allen County Right to Life, Indiana Right to Life, and Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
The 118th Indiana General Assembly began on January 7th. Legislators will be meeting for just 10 weeks this year, as it's a non-budget year, or a short session, as they call it. The pro-life lobby, which is led by Indiana Right to Life, is already in full gear advocating for new legislation to affirm and protect life in Indiana. Here to tell us more about that is Mike Fichter, Executive Director of Indiana Right to Life, and I'm Amanda Banks. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, Mike, as we look ahead at the next, about 9 weeks now, I believe we're looking at about three primary pieces of legislation that Indiana Right to Life is advocating for, hoping to advance through this legislative session. Why don't we just go through those one by one? I'll start with House Bill 1123. This is the bill that deals with Obamacare and the financial support for abortion that's currently required by private insurance carriers through Obamacare. Tell us, what would House Bill 1123 do?
Well, in a nutshell, what this bill will do is prevent private insurance carriers from covering abortion as part of their general policies. And here's why this is a big issue. There are only two ways that Hoosiers can buy health insurance now. One is through the federal health exchanges that have been set up. The other route is through private insurance plans. And listeners may recall that back in 2011, we were instrumental in passing legislation that opted out of most abortion coverage under the federal health care exchanges that had to be set up under the Obamacare Health Care Act. So we took care of the federal exchange side of everything. And honestly, unbeknownst to us at that point, there was going to emerge another issue on the private market. And that issue is this. The federal government, as required by Obamacare, has identified what's called the benchmark plan for private coverage in the state of Indiana. And that benchmark plan that's been selected by the federal government was a default of the state's largest small group insurance provider. That happens to be Anthem. And when you go to look at, actually on the Indiana Department of Insurance, when you go to their website and you click on the benchmark plan for the state of Indiana, and it'll open up Anthem's plan. And when you start to look at it, what you see right away is that Anthem provides coverage for abortions for any reason. In fact, it couldn't be any clearer on that. It states, regardless of medical necessity and by any means. But that is a blank check from Anthem saying that under the state benchmark private plan, any abortion that's legal in the state of Indiana will be covered by Anthem. Well, a lot of folks might think, well, that I just won't go with Anthem and we'll go with another private insurance carrier. That's where the trap is sprung through Obamacare on folks in Indiana, because what Obamacare requires is that every other private plan in the state of Indiana from this time forward needs to mirror the essential health benefits that are offered as part of the state's benchmark plan. That's why it's called a benchmark plan. Mm. The federal government has set it out there and said, here's the plan with the base essential coverage that everybody else on the market needs to copy. And so what that means now is if you're buying private insurance in the state of Indiana, that you are going to be forced by to an insurance plan that has abortion as part of its coverage, as reflected in the Anthem plan that's out there as the benchmark right now. So what this bill is going to do is directly address that by saying a general provision plan such as this cannot cover abortions unrestricted as it is right now. And if this law passes, which we are very optimistic that it will, then what that will do is it will change Anthem's benchmark plan, because Anthem will no longer be able to offer unrestricted abortion as part of its general policy. So when the benchmark plan changes, the mirror that everybody else has to reflect off of changes as well all the way down the line. But here's the key thing to understand. If you're paying into a policy, a general policy, and you're paying premiums every month, everything that that policy covers are things that your premium payments are helping to underwrite or subsidy. So that when you look at the Anthem plan, if you're on Anthem insurance and you're paying an Anthem premium, you're helping to subsidize abortion coverage in that plan as it stands right now. So circling all the way back around, what we want to do is extend the same protections that we were able to put onto plans in the federal exchanges through the opt-out in 2011. We want to provide those same protections in 2013 or 2014 now through this legislation so that we can protect Hoosiers from being forced, whether they want to or not, from being forced to pay into plans that are covering abortions.
If you're just joining us, I'm Amanda Banks, and I'm speaking with Mike Fichter from Indiana Right to Life about the legislative priorities for this General Assembly, which just came back into session on January 7th, and they're already off to quite a start. Considering some of this very legislation that we're updating you on today, as we move on now, Mike, why don't we talk about Senate Bill 228. This deals with women who are being coerced into an abortion and seeks to help ensure protection for them.
Yes, we have strong concerns, and this is not just based on speculation. This is based upon testimonies of women who have had abortion experiences, who have been through coercion and feeling forced into these situations. We're very concerned about that, and we think there needs to be legislation in the state that addresses this head on by making it a crime to coerce a woman to have an abortion. It should be a no-brainer to consider that. And yet when you look at the situations often involved with abortions and why women feel pressured to have abortions, peel back a couple of layers on that, and what you find are boyfriends that are threatening all kinds of different things if she doesn't have the abortion, parents in many circumstances that are threatening their daughters if they don't have this abortion. And no woman should have to undergo an abortion because she feels that there is a threat hanging over her if she does not go through with this procedure. So we want to see the state of Indiana be very clear that it is not permissible in this state for a woman to be coerced to have an abortion and to give her some type of reporting mechanism, some type of relief if she feels in any circumstance that she's being coerced, that she can contact somebody and state authorities will step into those situations.
Very good. I should mention Senate Bill 228, which Mike just explained, is being sponsored by Senator Toms. And the previous bill that we discussed, House Bill 1123, has been offered by Representative Thompson. A special thanks to both of those representatives for offering these strong pro-life measures. Thirdly, we would like to discuss a bill dealing with regulations on abortion clinics and abortionists themselves. I know this one is yet awaiting a bill number, but we will discuss it nonetheless and bring you up to date when we do have that. Mike, what sorts of regulations are we hoping to pass this year?
Well, right off the top, we want to come back around to legislation we've already passed that apparently is not being enforced, at least to our knowledge in the state of Indiana, and that is the requirement that any doctor doing abortions must have local hospital admitting privileges or a relationship with another physician who has those privileges. Now, listeners in Fort Wayne are very familiar with this situation since this is the primary reason that the abortionist in Fort Wayne is no longer, as of this broadcast, doing abortions in that city. But as we have checked around on this and asked various different officials at both the county and the state levels if they can verify whether any abortionist in the state of Indiana has admitting privileges or a relationship with somebody who's covering for him or her. And I can tell you, I have not spoken with one person at any level of government who can tell me definitively whether those admitting privileges are even being held by any of the doctors doing abortions in the state of Indiana. So what this legislation would do is say, okay, if this is not being enforced properly, which we don't believe it is, we're going to ramp it up and tighten this up by requiring that those admitting privileges must be in writing, and they must be filed with the Indiana Department of Health, and they must be filed with the County Health Department, and those will both be open to public inspection. They must also be kept on file at the facility that's doing abortions, and take all of this gray area out of this discussion on whether doctors have admitting privileges or not. It'll be very simple. We'll be able to contact the county or contact the state, see a copy of the written admitting privileges agreement, and if that copy doesn't exist, we'll ask for their license to be revoked to operate.
Well, that sounds very straightforward and something that's much needed. Also, Mike, tell me about the grandfather clause that currently exempts some abortion clinics from these building standards that really aren't being followed at this time.
Right. One of the great frustrations that we've experienced over the years is that we fought so hard back in 2005 to pass legislation that for the first time in Indiana since abortion became legal, we actually required licensing and inspection standards for every licensed abortion clinic in the state of Indiana. And we went through that battle, and the legislature threw it over to the Department of Health to create the standards for licensing. And the Department of Health came back with something we completely disagreed with. They basically exempted every abortion clinic operating prior to July 1, 2006 from meeting any of the physical building standards required for health and safety purposes. And, of course, we argued at that time that that undercut the entire reason for passing the legislation to create licensing and safety and health standards because they exempted all of these buildings from meeting those exact requirements that we fought so hard to get. We were told at that time, and I clearly remember standing in the hallway of Governor Daniel's office at that time and having a key staff person tell me, if any change occurs at any abortion clinic, such as they change a window, do any remodeling, anything like that, it would trigger an end to that grandfather clause. We have found that that has not been the case. We know of cases where there have been changes of ownership, where there has been all types of renovation done at some of these buildings, and yet the grandfather clause just continues to be extended. It's very clear at this point in our mind that the grandfather clause, as created by the Indiana State Department of Health, is meant to be a perpetual grandfather clause that these abortion clinics will never have to meet in the state of Indiana. We want the legislature to take action and say, enough is enough. The building standards were put into place for health and safety reasons, and we want to see that grandfather clause terminated. We don't know what the date of it is. It may be spelled out in that legislation, and I should know that, but we want to see that terminated so that the day will come where there is not a single abortion clinic in the state of Indiana that's exempted from meeting these building standards for health and safety requirements.
Mike, as always, I'm so glad that you are at the lead taking these important matters to the State House and with the team at Indiana Right to Life. I know that our concerns and these bills that we mentioned today are in great hands. Before we wrap up, I want to make sure that our listeners know the importance of contacting their legislators to explain their support for pro-life legislation. So again, Senate Bill 228, House Bill 1123, and this last bill that we discussed that's awaiting a bill number. But you could simply tell them that you support legislation to tighten regulations on abortion clinics. And also want to be sure that we mentioned to our listeners today that if they're in the Fort Wayne area, next Saturday, January 25th, we'll be hosting the 12th Annual Legislative Action Forum in Fort Wayne. That's going to take place at Concordia Theological Seminary. It's in Winnikin Hall, and it's in room 8 there at 9 a.m. It'll go till 10:30. And this is just a terrific time to hear directly from legislators. Commissioner Nelson Peters will be there, Senate President David Long, and Representative Matt Lehman will all be in attendance to answer your questions and to inform you about legislation that they are supporting both in the State House and then what's going on here locally. So again, Saturday, January 25th, the 12th Annual Legislative Action Forum at Concordia Theological Seminary. We hope to see you there. And if you need more information, please call 260-471-1849. That's 260-471-1849. Thank you, Mike, for your time today.
Thank you very much.
And now we bring you the conclusion to the conversation Kathy Humbarger began last week with David Meisner and Dr. Peter Scherer.
We're speaking with representatives from Shepherds United, the Pastors Coalition from Northeast Indiana that come from a variety of faith backgrounds. Certainly they agree that they have theological differences, but have come together to support what they do agree very strongly on, and that is the defense of innocent human life, traditional marriage, and the ability for each one of us to practice our faith without interference from the government. Dr. Scherer, help our listeners and me understand how this marriage issue then ties in to the life issue. We understand that it takes a man and a woman, a male and a female, however however you may manipulate that to create a child. But there are those that take the position that I can be very much pro-life and really not care much who parents the children as long as we protect the lives of the children. Could you speak to that a little bit and make that tie a little bit more clear for those who are listening?
Sure. And I think one way to think about it is, as you brought up, it's that a man and a woman come together, and from that union, a child comes. And what we've lost, I think, in our society is the thought of children being a precious gift. Sometimes I think we think of them as a commodity.
Well, on the other side, obviously, in some of the debates we've had over healthcare, even put pregnancy in the same category as a disease or an illness.
Right. And I think we have to think more long term here because, sure, you could say, look at the contraceptive thing. You save money by not having a child, really? Right now, we have a demographic problem in our country, and that is there aren't enough children to pay for your and my Social Security.
Right.
And I think part of the reason we've come to this place in our society is we have not valued children. And children here are our future. And when you think about, I also think about how is it that abortion came to be the way that it is? Why is it so prevalent? Partly, I think, is because we've lost the value of children. Partly is, I think, because the marital bonds themselves have been loosened. How sad it is when a single young girl comes into the abortion clinic because she has nowhere mm-hmm. to turn. She's by herself. She feels alone. And what we want to do is strengthen the bond between man and woman. We recognize in the biblical story, this sex is not a dirty thing. It's a beautiful thing. It's given to us by God. And in marriage, that which is beautiful becomes sacred. It's a sacred union. And what God meant to do in marriage is to provide an umbrella of protection and of love for that child. So a mother's love for a little child is precious and it can't be duplicated. But also think about the Christmas story. You have a Mother Mary there beautifully holding the baby Jesus. Well, God knew, though, they need someone else in that mm-hmm. family and gave as a stepfather to that child, Joseph. And Joseph was a protector for that little family. He is the one who took them off into Egypt so that the child Jesus could be saved from the evil tyrant Herod. And fathers have a role. So really, it's a sacred bond of family, I think, that we need to rediscover. And this is maybe just one issue that reminds us of the difficulties that we have, but also the opportunities that we have. This, to me, is a time of recovery. As you say, it's a time of forgiveness and of healing. But also, we can relearn some of the things that maybe we've forgotten as a society.
Indeed.
I think also we have to realize that a mother and a father each bring unique qualities to that home and what they instill in their kids. In my growing up, my dad was a very quiet person. I can't tell you a lot of profound things my dad said. My mom was the talker, the communicator, much more so. But each one of them instilled qualities in me that have helped to shape me and make me a part of who I am. Bring on into that picture my wife. We've been married 37 years. She's continued that process of helping to shape me and influence me in positive ways. I think we need to recognize that we have to have both the male and the female influence in the home, in the lives of our children. Dads are going to teach, if they're present, their sons what it means to be a man. They're going to teach them how to care for the young lady in their life later on. But earlier on, you know, how to care for their mother by the example that they mm-hmm. set. I think moms are going to teach those young men how to treat a woman, what a woman expects, and the encouragement that goes on there. I think a father teaches a young lady how to value herself mm-hmm. and not just to give herself away to someone else cheaply. I think a mother can also help reinforce the feminine side of that young lady. So both mom and dad are bringing qualities day in and day out to that child's lives. And many times we don't even think of them as being a lesson in life. We catch it rather than just hear it.
I used to tell my girls when they were growing up that they were in mom school, so we still chuckle about that. Dr. Scheer, we talk a lot about adoption in the context of the life issue and the fact that adoption is a much better choice than abortion when a young woman finds herself in the midst of a crisis pregnancy. We have those who say that there are loving same-sex couples that can provide homes for children who would otherwise not have a home at all, but perhaps spend their lives growing up in an institution or bouncing from one foster home to another. What is your take on adoption in terms of this whole discussion?
I understand the kind of sentiment, but I think we have to be very cautious here for a couple of reasons. One is we made mention of the fact that we all do best with a mom and dad. And I think about the way my own mother was growing up. She was kind of the center of the household, and everything kind of revolved around her, and my father was the head of the household. It's great to have a mom. I don't think it's really good to have two moms. The kind of confusion that brings into a household and the difficulty in trying to please the two women, I think would be very difficult. And also with two dads, they both might be very loving people, but neither one of them can be a mom. Now, I also think we have to be a little bit more aware, too, of the differences when we look at gay marriage has already been the law of the land in Northern Europe and other places besides Indiana for quite some time. And what we see in those relationships is typically different than we have in traditional marriage. It's an open secret, if it's a secret at all, that over half of homosexual relationships, the men are actually having partners outside of that relationship. And they're doing it openly and with the blessing of the other partner. And also, this is true that with the female-female relationships, these are notoriously fragile relationships, and they tend to last for not nearly as long as husband and wives. That's because they bring different issues to the table. They think about things differently. It's in marriage that we expect monogamy. It's in marriage that we expect exclusivity. And it's in traditional marriage that we expect till death do you part. Now, we don't care really whether people are best friends forever. If they do fall out of friendship, that's fine. But the reason that marriage is life, a lifelong union, is for the sake of stability. And then we have to think also, I think, across the generations, because marriage is the not only knits the fabric of the family, but it knits the fabric of the family through generations, with grandparents who also can be there for young parents and who can also be there for grandchildren. So I think the more we think about marriage, the more we often take it for granted, the more we'll recognize how much of our society depends on it.
Well, I'd like to pick up on the point that you made about the fragile nature of same-sex marriages in some of the countries where it's been the law of the land. Pastor Meisner, there are some, and many, in fact, that make the argument that heterosexual marriages haven't fared so well. So how can those who hold to the traditional definition of marriage attack the fragility of the homosexual relationships when heterosexual relationships aren't holding together?
I would agree with that. I mean, in the fact that when we look at, you know, traditional marriage in our country, the divorce rates are so high. We can even look at the church and find that there are many in the church who have grown up in the church, who have gotten married, who've had a divorce and have remarried. The issue is not necessarily the divorce or the success rate, and that would be the easy part to look at. It still goes back to the standard.
Right.
If you stand for nothing, you'll fall for anything, mm-hmm. as the old saying goes. I think when we see marriages fail in the heterosexual arena, they've failed not because it's a man and a woman. They've failed because perhaps that man and that woman have not been able to work and have not been committed to and have not been willing to sacrifice sometimes in order for that marriage to work. For anything in life, no matter what it is, to be successful, there has to be a give and a take, but there also has to be a common goal of what you're working towards and what you want to achieve. That's true on a sport team. That's true in business. That's true in the home. Almost every arena that you look at, there have to be common goals, common standards, common objectives.
Dr. Scheer, you've based a lot of your positions that you've explained and shared with us on the fact that marriage is good for children. What about those who can't have children? Do the same principles apply, or does that dilute your argument at all that marriage is all about children?
Well, I think that we apply the same standards. There have been many infertile couples that later on find out that they could have children, so it's hard to know exactly. But we're thinking about marriage as an institution. And as an institution, it's something to be held sacred and set apart. Because whether one couple happens to be infertile or not doesn't change the fact that it's only in the union of one man and one woman that children come from. And as a society, we better take that seriously, or the seriously we take it, the more difficulties we're going to have.
I think that's where the beauty of marriage and adoption come together. If you have a couple who cannot have children together naturally, adoption is a beautiful alternative to help them, you know, round out their family, their goals, their desires, and at the same time, provide for that child who finds themselves in a scenario where they're unwanted. But the bottom line is that young couple still has to work at what their goals are. They still have to adhere to those standards. In fact, they may have to even work a little harder because of the disappointments of not being able to have children together.
This has certainly been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much to Dr. Peter Scheer and Pastor David Meisner of Shepherds United for helping us understand the importance of the traditional marriage argument that is raging, actually, in our state. Hopefully, you've been given some food for thought, and if you have taken the position that there is no connection between being pro-life and a disregard for traditional marriage, I hope what we've shared today will give you some ideas to think about. As always, please feel free to contact us via our website, ichooselife.org, if we've stirred some questions in your mind. And I'm certain that we'll be revisiting this issue as the days and weeks go by. Thanks again for joining us today. God bless you as you go about your week, and thank you for standing with us for life.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program, or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to ichooselife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.